From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, a roundtable discussion on the progress Milwaukee has made in the 50 years since Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. What issues still remain for people across the spectrum?
For so long, this country, people have been so scared of specific communities being empowered and not allowing them just to move forward.
Later, many legal obstacles to racial justice have been cleared, but one advocate says many challenges remain.
It's hard on people not to have access to the ballot box because that's where often changes can take place. So I think progress comes slowly, and sometimes it's definitely not as fast as any of us would like it to be.
Those interviews plus much more when Lake Effect comes your way after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Today marks 50 years since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. took to the National Mall before an audience of hundreds of thousands of people in Washington and millions around the world to call for not only an end to racism, but for financial equality. A lot of progress has been made during that time across the country and in Milwaukee, but major problems still remain. We're going to spend the first half of today's show examining the state of the legacy of those events a half century ago. We convened a roundtable of eight people from the community to gauge how the Milwaukee area is doing when it comes to reaching Dr. King's goals. The participants include Maria Castrillon Perez, Tracy Johnson, Thomas Kelly, Margaret Rosga, Nick Reindl, Alex Runner, Keith Stanley, and Angela Walker. They spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis.
Every year and every day and every week, there's always something in the news about where we are in Milwaukee is in terms of social issues and economic issues that aren't necessarily favorable to the city. So if you just look at that, you'd say Milwaukee is a place that I don't want to go. And so one of the questions that I have is that really where we are in Milwaukee? Is that the reality here?
You know, you hear just these random statistics that are thrown out sort of to bash Milwaukee. Oh, look, you have 50% unemployment, African-American men. You know, what's wrong with Milwaukee? It's easy to just sort of simply, on a surface level, look at that without digging into, you know, what are the issues and the complexity of, you know, you have John Daniels, who's chairman of one of the largest law firms in Milwaukee. You have Common Council President Hines, the first African-American in history to be Common Council President more than one term. You have Will Allen. You have all these leaders. I mean, I live in a neighborhood. It's probably 80 to 90% African-American. A lot of young men who are sort of off the grid. You know, they're not applying for jobs. They don't have resumes. But as Peggy said, they have loads of potential and talent, and they feel disconnected from the system. So you can just throw out that number and say, oh, 50% unemployment, you guys should do something about that. Or you can actually get to know Skyler, who lives across the street from me, who has these great cooking skills, and I was able to take him to MATC. Now he has a culinary degree. Now he's doing well. I think to enter into the situation of an individual, and that's what really comes across in the speech to me that Dr. King gave, is that we're all individuals, and none of us are sort of off the hook. You know, he says at one point, in the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. And I think that goes for all of us. You know, there are suburbanites who sort of kind of spew out this hatred and bitterness toward the city. There are people in the city who spew out hatred and bitterness toward the suburbs. None of that is productive. And I think you have to enter in to each situation and look at everyone as an individual with strengths and challenges.
How do we make people take ownership for that? I think as a Milwaukee and someone who works in the city, someone who owns a property in the city but is a suburbanite, I have to look realistically at these numbers. And I think we all sitting around this table here, and there's so many people doing such positive things that want to focus on the bright spots. How far does that go? And is that really going to change these numbers? I mean, think about the dollars and the resources that are allocated towards all of these programs, where I think people aren't talking about how do we really solve the issue. They're raising money for this, or they're rallying people around this. How do we come together? I think there's a lot to be said for what's going on, you know, at City Hall or, you know, at the county level. How do we get on the same page to really address this issue that we all talk about.
I think it's difficult to get on the same page because I think there's a lot of people who don't live in Milwaukee who've kind of viewed it as a failed project that, you know, deindustrialization or deunionization and all the problems that are befitting one half of the city, almost a whole half of the city, that, you know, we should just throw our hands up in the air. But I also think part of that is a perception issue that's pushed by certain interests, certain media interests, certain political interests, that it benefits them to have Milwaukee be weak, to have Milwaukee be going down. And I'm not a native of Milwaukee. I've lived here for almost 10 years. I've lived in other places too. And I mean, really, compared to other big cities in this country, we're doing very well. There are some serious, serious, serious issues. But in the other places I've lived, on the East Coast and other places, we're doing much better than other places. We have some fantastic, thriving neighborhoods, even in the places that people think are, you know, dangerous or scary or they've failed. There are good people. They're very good people. They're good homeowners. They're good families. And how do we fix it? I think we could probably sit here for a couple of days and talk about all that. But I think getting maybe some jobs. And how do you do that? That's probably above my pay grade. I don't know.
You got to start somewhere. And if we could say education is an issue, if we could say crime is an issue, gun violence is an issue, why can't we identify that one issue and just allocate our resources towards it?
I would say I think there is one issue, and this is difficult. I think for not just for the urbanites and for the suburbanites, from my white brothers and sisters, my Hispanic brothers and sisters, and my black. I think the issue, at least for me, the key issue is empowerment. And for so long, this country, people have been so scared of specific communities being empowered and not allowing them just to move forward and empower them. What I mean by that is that you rarely hear people say, listen, and I wish some of my conservative brothers and sisters would say this, I can't help you out. I don't have the money, the resources, the time, or I'm just tired out. But listen, you can do this. You have the resources. A lot of times you hear what I can't do. And as an African-American growing up in the city of Milwaukee, I was used to that. You know, you can't do this. We don't want you living here. We don't want you doing this. We don't want you shopping here. If that is the case, even if racism is alive and well, you know what? Listen, I don't know what it's like to live in the hood, as people would say. But you have the resources to change your community. You never hear that empowerment message. You don't hear from my conservative brothers and sisters as far as they're playing up to their constituency. You don't even hear from my liberal brothers and sisters who are playing up saying, we need more government. Even if you took away government and took away all the social programs, I hear more messages about not smoking as opposed to being a father. You know, I would love to see a commercial that says, you know what, 60% of African-American boys and children won't grow up without a father. We need you to be a father. You don't hear those messages. To me, and I guess I'm a marketing guy, I would love to see us market those values, those principles, so we don't have to spend another dime on welfare and just say, you know, we took welfare away, and I guess that would be some of my conservatives, brothers and sisters, that would be their dream, which is fine. But then why aren't we saying, listen, though, the stats say if there's a mother and father in this household, you know, I hear more about gay rights. I hear more about every other issue when it comes to the African-American people, specifically in the city of Milwaukee and around this country. Rarely do I come on the television. I come on the radio and say, you know what? If you educate your child, you don't hear about education. You don't hear about fathers. You don't hear about unemployment. I would love to say, listen, if you're looking for a job, a 30-second spot, pull your pants up. You don't hear that. All you hear is that how bad we are as a people, how we're a black eye to the city of Milwaukee because our employment. You never hear the empowerment message. I won't spend another dime on you, but listen, here's how I made it. You don't hear those stories, specifically coming from the outsiders of this.
Let me pick up the racism point that you touched on just a minute ago because I think that needs elaboration. I worked for 28 years in Waukesha County. I heard how people talk about coming to Milwaukee. I know people who have come to Milwaukee and gone all the way to Good Hope Road and then down to 43 before they come downtown because they're trying to avoid everything that's dangerous. I think Milwaukee is a code word outside of Milwaukee for African American, or it's a code word for people of color. And I think we have to address that racism. I think we have to call it out for what it is.
Well, I think as a person of color, I mean, I grew up in outstate Wisconsin. It is a code word. People, I mean, there's this idea that it's some sort of almost, it's almost silly. It's like this comic book-like dystopia. And I think if people really got in, I mean, just go to the Fond du Lac Avenue Farmers Market on a Saturday. People would think that, you know, I don't want to go to Fond du Lac Avenue. It's a wonderful place.
We'll take a quick break now and then continue our roundtable discussion in just a moment on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Let's get back to our roundtable discussion on the Milwaukee legacy of the March on Washington, which took place 50 years ago today. We're hearing from Maria Castrillon Perez, Tracy Johnson, Thomas Kelly, Margaret Rosga, Nick Reindl, Alex Runner, Keith Stanley, and Angela Walker in conversation with WUWM's Latoya Dennis.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a second, though, right? So why would you want to come to Milwaukee, though, if what you hear and what you read on the daily basis about the very violent summer that we're having, or about the blackmail unemployment rate or the recidivism rate, or what's going to bring me here?
Some of it's on the media because, I mean, we just had this great celebration at Bronzeville Week. There was no violence. We celebrated all these entrepreneurs, all these young businesses, old businesses, businesses that are leaving suburban areas, coming to MLK. I don't know that I read one article about it. Now, if there is a shooting, we may see six or seven articles about it. You know, I have relatives. I have close family members in Waukesha and Brookfield. I had one of them come up to me and say, there is a shooting in downtown Milwaukee every day. I said, that's just completely wrong. There hasn't been a shooting in downtown Milwaukee since President Teddy Roosevelt was shot by a white guy. So, I mean, you know, people have these perceptions. And the reverse also, Keith and I, when we were working in City Hall, I just shared this really quickly. We had a guy from New York come, and he said, there is no city in the world better for African-American men than Milwaukee. We said, oh, that's interesting. We don't hear that very often. What do you mean? He said, you can buy a property in the city of Milwaukee for a dollar. And this is what he did. And you can rehab it, and you can build a business. And in New York, you can't buy anything for a dollar. He said, you can't buy an empty lot for $500,000. But I came to Milwaukee because I saw opportunity. And everywhere I look, I see opportunity. And Keith mentioned the mindset. You know, you can have a mindset of empowerment, which this young African-American man did. You know, he's a millionaire now. He's a self-made man. He had a mindset of empowerment when he came to this city. Or you can have a mindset of defeatism. And everywhere you look, and I'm not someone who says racism doesn't exist. I see it all the time. I see young men in my neighborhood getting, you know, having to sit on the curb with their hands behind their back just if they get pulled over for speeding. I've never had to sit on a curb when I've gotten pulled over for speeding. I've never seen a white person have to sit on a curb. So racism does exist, not just police, but all different spheres. At the same time, I see people like Keith, and I see people like this gentleman I'm talking about who have a mindset that I really can do anything, and I have this great potential and this great talent.
I think the biggest thing is more attention to a family atmosphere for the kids. Just a little history for you. In 1963, the black families headed by married couples was 70%. Today, about the reverse is true. As the saying goes, all change in America begins at the dinner table. The kids need to be held accountable for their actions. You know, you can pump all this money into schools, but it's not going to go anywhere if the kids don't straighten themselves up and pull up their pants or cut themselves dressed and make sure their homework is done.
Well, can I just challenge one thing? I think there is some validity for sure to what you're saying. I mean, and that's what Dr. King says in his speech. He says all of us can do better. At the same time, you know, what I shared about earlier about, I mean, I've seen young men in my neighborhood who are going to college, they're doing everything that they're supposed to do.
Sure.
But there's a perception of them where people see them as scary, and people see them as, oh, they may not fit my quote-unquote corporate mold. Or, you know, I mean, I've seen this happen again and again where there's a woman who has a PhD. She's an African-American woman. There's an HR department in our city that thought she wasn't a good candidate for a job, or she was eminently qualified for, I should say. I had an experience where some young men in my neighborhood, they were just kind of talking to me, kind of being a little bit loud like I was when I was in high school going to Whitefish Bay. Four police officers came out of the darkness, just threw them on the ground without them saying anything. Now they have a ticket. I had to talk to their police captain to get that ticket waived. I just think there's less room for error with African-American men especially, whereas me, as a Caucasian man, you know, there's more latitude. I can get second, third, fourth, fifth chances. I have a broad network. You know, I have generational means and generational wealth. So I'm not trying to let people off the hook, but I think it's more complex than to just say young African-American men need to do better, because there are times when they absolutely do need to be held into account and they need to do better and they need to pull up their pants. There are other times when they pull up their pants and they put on a suit and tie and they do everything right and they go into the job interview, but the odds are stacked against them.
But a company is going to hire the best qualified candidate.
You would hope.
As a woman, mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about, you know, pay parity and equality as well. And we had a recent situation where a friend of mine was on a nominating committee for a board position. And they were looking at a number of candidates. One happened to be a woman. And she said, I would love to give this position to the woman, but she wasn't the best qualified candidate. And I think that woman would understand why she wasn't chosen for that position. And I think if it's about the equal opportunity. And I think that really, you know, getting back to some of the points made earlier, is there equal opportunity in the system that we have in place? And, you know, there are people saying no. Some people would say yes. And I think the bigger question is then how do we make that possible?
As a person that stands at the intersection of race and gender, and as a person who is from one of the neighborhoods that people skirt, my family's on 19th and Keefe, as a person who is from a fatherless home, our issues in our communities run so much deeper than pulling up your pants. I mean, I hear that so much. I can understand where it comes from, but the whole idea of if you're just respectable enough, things will be different for you, that is not my reality. It's built into the system that certain groups are not to have access no matter what you do. There was a police chief stopped and frisked in a suit in New York. Being dressed respectably, quote unquote, did not save him. I understand what your point is that, you know, you have to value education. You have to value those things. But if you are coming out of a system and your environment where you are told constantly that you are not to be successful, that those are not things that you need to even be thinking about, that you are never going to get past this point. What do we expect to see on our streets when you have taken, you know, it takes a long time for people. You can tell someone something over and over and over again. Certain people are not going to accept that. But there are a whole lot of people who are when they don't see anything different. So what I'm looking at is I understand, you know, pull your pants up. I get all that because I'm sure as a 39-year-old grandmother, I've said the same thing to people. But at the same time, we have to look much deeper. The root is not in respectability. Poverty is violence.
I will say this, Angela. I think I totally agree with you. Martin Luther King's speech was about jobs and freedom. With that being said, I had a brain freeze about a year ago. I went to a community brainstorming meeting, and a UWM group of students, graduate students, that did a report, and it was the same statistics. African-American males are the last hire, first fired, and they was going through all the statistics, and I totally understood them. But what bothered me was that I was looking around the room, and I saw 60, 70, even 80-year-old people shaking hands, see? And they kept saying, see, told you, no one wants to listen to us. See, told you, no one wants to listen to us. And it bothered me that seeing that image, my Hispanic brothers and sisters, I think they got us when it comes to this, is that my metaphor is that within the African-American community, something happened with the baby boomer generation, with King's generation, where we came up to a stop sign, and we can put that stop sign as racism, we can put that stop sign as anything, even gender issues, social issues. And instead of acknowledging the stop sign but saying that we're going to put the gas to the pedal and still move forward, we stopped. We got out the car, we looked, and we've been there ever since. And it bothers me when I go to some of these events and I hear, and people, for some reason, especially with the baby boomer generation, they want validation that racism still exists. And my issue is like, so what? It's been here since the beginning of time. It will be here long gone when we're gone. My problem is that why haven't we said to ourselves, like my Hispanic brothers and sisters have said, that we're going to move forward no matter what? We have children that our own children are dying. Our own children are not being educated. Our communities. So if you don't like me, if you don't hire me because I'm black, so what? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to at least get up in the morning and sweep my porch. I'm going to at least get up and clean my street. At least I'm going to get up and go to Menards and get some off-color paint for a dollar and paint my porch. For some reason, we've lost the disconnect just because racism exists. Now, oh, we can't do anything. When I see brothers hanging on the corners, I get it, man. You don't have a job. That does not mean to give you the right to intimidate people. It doesn't give you the right to treat people with disrespect. It doesn't give you the right to shoot a bus driver in the leg if that would happen. It bothers me that for some reason, this generation, the baby boomer generation, and every generation afterwards within African-American community has got stuck on racism. It's always will be here. And that's what bothers me. Something happened with the gatekeeping within our community about principles and morals and values. Yes, racism exists. But still, what happened that we didn't say, I'm not going to let my son die or my daughter die or my son and daughter not get educated just because someone is not going to hire me. So what? You're not going to hire me? I'm going to keep going.
I am that baby boom generation. I am, participated in the movement for fair housing, among other things. When I go to talk about those events, I don't talk about them to indulge in nostalgia. I know there are some people for whom the door opened and they walked through and they see the civil rights movement as having been successful and that's the end of it. And they are the ones holding up the stop sign. I just am a little uncomfortable with the degree of your generalization. Milwaukee has a tradition of young people standing up for justice. And when young people today find that out, history that has been kept from them, they find it tremendously empowering. The racism and economic problems, and they are related, are great so that it takes a multiplicity of approaches to deal with it. So if your approach is different than mine, I think that's fine because we have to work on different things.
You know, I want to go back with Keith. I think he's made some really great points in regard to that aspect of being that entrepreneur. And I when I look at Latinos and I look at, you know, what we do in the League of United Latin American Citizens, there's three factors that come out very clearly to me. And that's the aspect of family, faith, and perseverance. Much of what we're dealing with right now is the whole aspect of immigration. So we're going back to the days of the Germans. We're coming back to the days of the Irish coming. We're dealing with right now what the perception is of what a Latino or, as some may say, a Hispanic. I look at the aspect of those three factors, which gives me energy, you know, and I need the energy from our youth and what we try to do with LULAC to empower our youth, how we serve as leaders within our community, and the importance that we've really put as Latino leaders that we're connecting. Whether we agree or we disagree, LULAC is nonpartisan. And we go times where it's comfortable, it's uncomfortable, but we have to have those discussions. And I think this is a great opportunity to have those discussions. Our realization of what everyone is. You may look at me and say, ella mira una güera. She doesn't look like she's Latina. People may not think there's Salvadoranians that are here in Milwaukee, you know. But that's this discussion that we have of how we empower and understand all about the aspect of perception. With family, the reason I put out family is because where does it start? I'm not saying that your family has to be a man, a woman, a child. I'm saying if there's a little boy in your neighborhood, you gave the example, Alex. You gave the example of picking that person that's across the street, being that neighbor to that individual, bringing them along.
Now, I would like to touch on something that Alex has kind of in a roundabout way brought up a couple of times, and it's segregation in Milwaukee. We're often cited as one of the most segregated cities in the country. And Alex has said that, you know, I live in a neighborhood that's 90% black. Alex is a white guy, obviously. And so are we really that segregated here? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that the census data, you know, reveals one part of the discussion. And I'm not always comfortable in this seat, but I'll just throw this out there that just because you have an African-American neighborhood or Latino neighborhood doesn't necessarily mean it's segregated. So it can. You know, Hollywood Park is this wonderful neighborhood, upper middle class African-Americans, all have steady jobs. They got a nice little gathering restaurant nearby, Garfield's 502. It's all African-American. And beautiful green lawns, you know, it's almost like walking into Fox Point or something. That's 100% African-American neighborhood, just about. Does that mean it's a segregated neighborhood? You know, one thing that some of the older generation would say to Keith and I when we worked in City Hall, they would say, I like living with black people. I'm more comfortable around black people. So if there are situations where African-Americans are being prevented or dissuaded or disencouraged to move to certain areas, or economics are preventing them to have access to certain things, or vice versa. You know, if a Caucasian person wants to live in an African-American neighborhood and is being discouraged, I mean, that's obviously wrong. And I think there are still some elements of that. But sometimes people want to be around similar people. Mm-hmm. So when I say the census data in terms of this race lives here, equals segregation, I'm just not always comfortable with that.
And we've had this discussion before about, you know, the fact that it's based on socioeconomics. I mean, we can sit here and have this discussion and talk about going to different neighborhoods and trying different food. So many people in the inner city, I would venture to guess, have not stepped outside of, you know, they don't even know that Lake Michigan exists. Mm-hmm. And they haven't seen it. And it's because, you know, we're actually having this conversation on a totally different level from, I think, where the real problems are. And if I were to venture a guess, is that Dr. King, in his remarks, was talking not only to, you know, us sitting here around the table here, but those who are living in the inner city who don't have access to, you know, those opportunities. And how do we create that? And I think that's the question we've all asked and have tried to answer.
I would also say, I mean, I've lived in other places. One thing I think is striking about Milwaukee is that there really are no suburbs where there's a very large black middle class.
Yeah, that's true.
And almost every other major city, there's, you know, like in Chicago or Detroit or Washington or Baltimore or even New York, there are suburbs where, you know, that's 40, 50, even 60 or 70% black, and they're all middle class to upper middle class professionals. And that doesn't really exist here. We have a black middle class. We have some black upper class, but it's not it's one of the I think one of the most striking things about Milwaukee is that once you get to the suburbs, you can cross maybe 10 blocks. You go from 89% black to 89% white. People do enjoy living usually among people who look like them and are similar to them culturally. But I think that's the striking part. There are other cities in this country where you see similar things, where you have very white suburbs and very black inner city neighborhoods, but usually have a middle. And we don't really seem to have the middle.
I think we're moving more towards interacting. I live in East Wauwatosa with my Puerto Rican partner. I think we might be the darkest two people in the area that I'm in, but we represent. I see a lot of diversity with young people, you know, high schoolers, middle schoolers. They are diverse groups of kids that are hanging out. I'm seeing that more and more everywhere I go. So speaking to what you said, Ms. Peggy, about youth and you know, they're in the right direction. I mean, we blast them for a lot of things, but they are actually saying, you know, this invisible wall that used to exist between the north side and the south side, and you don't cross it, that doesn't exist for a lot of young people anymore.
Our roundtable included the voices of Angela Walker, Keith Stanley, Alex Runner, Nick Reindl, Margaret Rosga, Thomas Kelly, Tracy Johnson, and Maria Castrillon Perez, in conversation with WUWM's Latoya Dennis. You can hear more of their conversation at WUWM.com. Our conversation about racial justice continues with one organization working to spark the discussion throughout the community. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we marked the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington with a roundtable discussion on the legacy of that historical event. One Milwaukee organization that consistently works to keep issues of racial justice front and center is the YWCA of Southeast Wisconsin. Martha Berry is the group's racial justice director, and she joins us to continue the conversation now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
We talk a lot about racial justice and progress in this society and even in this city. What's actually being done on the ground level? What do we mean when we talk about progress?
Progress is a hard word in a city like Milwaukee, where there are so many disparities that we're facing, everything from jobs to transportation to housing, discrimination, things that we think we've made some progress on. But I think we have to remember that there are lots of feet on the ground doing important work and many groups that have tried to tackle the issue in their sphere of influence. We ourselves convene people in a class called Unlearning Racism, Tools for Action. It's a six-part series where we try to take apart the misnomers of all the misinformation we've heard about race. I think most of us, if we went back and thought about our history classes, would agree we didn't get a good history lesson in terms of what went on around race issues in our nation's history. And so we get people to come together and look at some of those issues, debunk a lot of the myths that are out there, and then invite people to take action in their sphere of influence.
Take a step back before you get too far. Myths about race, myths about progress, what are the myths that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think the myths are probably both. I think the myths are about race. I think they're about racism. I think some people want to believe we've made progress because we have a black president, because President Obama has, you know, moved and elevated the conversation. And I think, you know, while that's true, it's very true that we have, I think there's so many places where we want to go with Dr. King's, the content of someone's character, not the color of their skin, and relegate race to the sidebar conversation. So progress to me is continuing to have those conversations. If we're having the conversations about race, we can move the conversation forward.
Who are the people you're enrolling in these classes?
It's really a mix of people. We've got some folks that come from businesses, some government workers. We've got a lot of nonprofits who are working with people who are disenfranchised or being targeted by issues around race and therefore trying to get good information, trying to figure out what they can do. We were lucky enough to work with an organization that really wanted to look at their hiring practices. So we tailored the class and shortened it to help them to look at what's happening in terms of people not even getting in the door, not actually getting the interviews, not being able to advance in the career opportunity that exists within that organization. So trying to find ways to work with organizations to help them to see where their barriers may be.
Do you worry that some of the people who might most benefit from a conversation like this are the ones least likely to be involved in a conversation like this?
You know, yes and no. One would say, the people who most need to be there are likeliest to not even hear about the course, which is very true. But we do get a mix of people who come in because somebody else told them about it, a friend. We had one guy come because his wife told him he had to. You know, so we've had a mix of people who feel obligated by nature of their work, but others come because they're curious and they want to know how we can advance the conversation. We take it very slowly in the beginning stages to get people warmed up to talking about race and talking about progress, talking about racism, because it's not for white people in particular, it's not a conversation topic at dinner every night. And so getting people comfortable having those conversations is often where we have to start and move things along. So we use videos, we use small group conversations, we use listening pairs, opportunities for people to get their voice started. What do I think? You know, what are the myths I've been taught? You know, I think you can't grow up in this society and not be imbued with lots of myths in terms of race. So slowly moving people along a continuum, wherever they start, trying to move them ahead.
Do we run a risk in lumping all elements of racial justice together under this one umbrella term? I mean, racial justice can involve attitudes. It can involve legal issues. It can involve employment. It can involve housing. Is there a risk in lumping all of these things together under this one umbrella term?
Yeah, the umbrella term of racial justice. Absolutely, Mitch. I think there's ways that it can relegate it to the this is impossible to change mentality where people feel I can't do anything, so it's hopeless and I give up now before I even start. We try to say to people there's lots of ways to look at racism. There's the individual side, you know, in terms of we've moved past the places where people throw out the racial slurs and the racial epithets. So things are better, but they're not because people still think those thoughts. So your sense about attitudes is very true. Where racism has its greatest hold is on the institutions that appear to have race-neutral policies but still have a disparate impact on people. So the structural racism that runs within our society is the place where people feel very hopeless that they can make any difference. And that's where we have to change and invite people into the conversation. Maybe that feels too big. So what is the piece that you can tackle? You know, what is something that you can do to move the conversation forward? Where can you speak up? In organizations where there's people around a table having a conversation and the person of color potentially tries to bring up an issue that's of concern to them, and white people need to be able to listen to that thoughtfully and then take up that banner and say more, speak up in situations that might feel like I didn't do enough, but starting the conversation, keeping the conversation going, keeping momentum moving forward can make a big difference. So, yeah, I think we run the risk in terms of racial justice as a big, broad umbrella, but I don't think we can afford not to have everything under that big top and try to move the needle.
Well, and I wonder if it's in some ways more challenging today for people working in issues of racial justice because there aren't the same kind of overt laws to work against.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's places where we've made progress. You can certainly say, you know, we have advanced a certain conversation and laws and policies and practices within organizations have improved. But I also think there's ways that, you know, looking at what the Supreme Court did in terms of voting rights and how that really has a disparate impact on people who don't have access to their birth certificate or voter ID, you know, just some ways in which it's hard on people not to have access to the ballot box because that's where often changes can take place. So I think progress comes slowly and sometimes it's not as – it's definitely not as fast as any of us would like it to be.
Where do kids fit in this equation?
Well, young people certainly get imbued with the messages at home, at church, you know, in the neighborhoods that they live in. But young people can also be the next generation that says, well, why does it have to be that way? And isn't afraid to ask the tough questions and move things forward. I think there's some young people that we relegate to the sidebar conversations and say, you know, but those young people can't possibly be contributors to the conversation. But often the people most targeted by an issue, in this case race, have a lot to say in terms of what that has meant for their lives and the ways that it's limited them. So holding high expectations for our young people and assuming that we haven't figured it out and you can do more. So I think we all can. So how do we know we're making progress? I think the challenge in terms of looking at it is what are the steps that we're doing? What are we doing in terms of convening conversations? So we annually have our evening to promote racial justice. We invite lots of people to come, generally around 500 join us. This year we'll have an opportunity to invite a speaker in Harry Belafonte, who was certainly one of the architects of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom back in 1963. And we'll have a conversation with him about where have we been, Harry, and where are we going? Give us a picture, Mr. Belafonte, of what difference has the country made. In terms of us as the YWCA, it's a bold mission, eliminating racism, empowering women, and promoting peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all. It's not a small vision of what we want to see happen. So we've decided that we have to keep convening. We have to keep bringing people together and having those conversations. So we do this class twice a year. We have a teen social justice camp in the summers. We do teen programming during the course of the year. So we're constantly trying to bring people together who might not otherwise be in the same room and have those conversations, get people conversing about the issues. What are the hard issues that they're facing in their neighborhoods? In our community, and how do we move things forward?
Do you feel at times like you are taking a teaspoon and trying to empty Lake Michigan?
There are times, yes, absolutely, times you wake up. But as a white woman, what I know is that I get the choice to wake up and decide to do something about race and racism. As a person of color, they are going to get targeted by issues of race on a daily basis, which is exhausting. And they don't get the opportunity to decide not to do something. So I have decided that I have to hold in my mind racism will end. We have to point ourselves in the direction. It's sort of like listening to all the speeches that are going on right now in terms of the 50th anniversary. And one was referring back to Kennedy talking about President Kennedy wanted to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade and did it. And every time there was a setback, you know, the engineers couldn't figure something else out. They kept saying, but this is our goal. We must move the needle in terms of that. So I have to keep thinking about what else can we do? Okay, that didn't work. It's sort of like, all right, that didn't work. That conversation didn't go well. I have to try again. What would that try again look like?
Martha Berry, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch. I appreciate it.
Martha Berry is Racial Justice Director for the YWCA of Southeast Wisconsin. You can find a link to more about the group's racial justice programs and their December 3rd evening to promote racial justice at wuwm.com/lakeeffect.
How many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free?
The protests of the civil rights movement had their own soundtrack, sung by folk musicians, R&B stars, and the protesters themselves. Recently in Madison, singing protesters have been making themselves heard in the state capitol building, and that has Lake Effect essayist Avi Lank thinking.
Pity the poor workers in our state capitol. Almost every day at noon for months now, They have been subject to singing by folks upset with the policies of Governor Walker and the Republican-led legislature. Walker and lawmakers have offices in the building, as does the state Supreme Court. The singers have declined to get a permit for what they see as exercising their constitutional rights, and Capitol Police, led by a chief who just got a hefty raise, have begun to arrest them. The sight of singers, many older and with long hair, being hauled away in handcuffs has hit YouTube. This has delighted some and disgusted others, depending on their political feelings. Earlier this month, a video even circulated showing a Capitol policeman politely telling folks watching the Songfest from the balcony of the Capitol Rotunda that they, too, might be subject to arrest. Many were just curious and from out of state. State officials wisely backed down from that threat, I assume because they realized how weak and petty it looked. But the video led to an interesting thought, calling to mind the sage advice to keep one's friends close but one's enemies closer. If the governor wanted to exploit the situation for all it is worth, he should stop fighting the singers and instead embrace them as a wonderful manifestation of Wisconsin's culture. He should direct state officials to start promoting them as a tourist attraction. I wonder how long the Songfest would last if he did that.
Avril Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than 35 years. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in Milwaukee Magazine and Corporate Report Wisconsin, among other places. One last break, and then a Wisconsin nature writer has some advice for people seeking Wisconsin nature, animals in particular. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Was a loser, now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Labor Day weekend is a great time to get out and see some animals. But if the crowds or the prices of zoos are too much for you, Wisconsin offers plenty of free opportunities to see animals in their natural habitats instead. Nature and travel author Candace Gockel-Andrews' latest book is a guide to seeing native animals in Wisconsin in their natural habitat. The book is called Travel Wild Wisconsin, and earlier this summer, Gockel-Andrews told Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson about the specific animals we should see this time of year.
Summer's a good time to get involved, I would say, with tagging monarch butterflies. That's something you can easily do. You just have to go to monarchwatch.org, and you can learn how to tag butterflies, and you can even get a little tagging kit for a small fee that they charge there. What's amazing is some of these monarchs are making a 3,000-mile migration from Canada to Mexico. So there is a chapter, of course, on that in the book, but summer's a great time to be looking for the monarchs. I think it's also a great time to look for white-tailed deer, and one place to do that is to take an auto tour through the Sandhill Wildlife Area in Babcock. And
wouldn't the cars scare them away, though?
The cars?
Yeah.
No, actually what this is it's a huge enclosure. So I think it's a 9,000-acre enclosure, and the deer herd inside the enclosure, they are wild. They don't know actually that they're enclosed, but this car route is a 14-mile route, and you just, you know, drive slowly. Deer are usually seen either in the early morning hours or toward dusk. And I've gone through there many times, and almost always I've seen deer. So they're relatively close. Usually they're browsing, and you can find them. I think it's another great time of year to look for loons. Loons are out on our lake. Some are actually incubating eggs right now, or they do have their young with them. So we're very lucky, especially in Wisconsin, because we're one of the few states that have loons. With the red eyes, because they only have those in the summer, and we have loons here in the summer, so we get to see those brilliant red eyes and then their distinctive kind of black and white plumage. And, you know, it's always a good time to look for elk in the Shawmagon.
Sounds wonderful. And I like with the portion with the loons, you're talking about the different loon calls, and that was fascinating for me.
Yeah, they do make some very distinctive calls. They're territorial calls. There are calls to communicate with the other loons on the lake, and there's yodels and wails, and yeah, they make a lot of vocalizations.
So how did you find these animals?
When I thought of doing the book, I just started to think of, I wanted to make sure that I was including only the native animals to Wisconsin. So I started to make a list of the animals that we that were native to the state. And then I wanted to make sure that there was a place, sort of a natural area, a place of natural beauty that you could go to encounter these animals. And then I also wanted sort of a third criteria for each chapter was that I wanted this to be something that you could do for very little money to have a genuine encounter with this particular form of wildlife. So I didn't want any expensive trip or, you know, animals in zoos, although zoos are fine. This is just having encounters with wild animals, thus Travel Wild Wisconsin.
Right, and it sounds like they're just in their natural habitat, which is probably a little more interesting of an experience than just going to a zoo and seeing them caged up.
Right. I mean, I think that's true because you actually do see them where they live and how they interact with that environment. So it is a little more genuine.
How long did it take you to research these animals then?
It took about a year to go to all the places and talk with all the researchers and biologists and citizen scientists and volunteers that I talked with. So I would say that the research part of this takes about a year. It takes another year to actually sit down and write the book and then, of course, it takes another year to get the production going and the book actually printed. So it's been a 3-year process altogether.
Did you leave any of the animals out, or did you just stick with these 12?
You know, there were some that I wanted to include, for instance, like black bears. I think black bears are, you know, they're really an iconic Wisconsin animal. But unfortunately, there's not really a structure for you to go out safely and seek an encounter with a black bear. So I did leave that out. Now, I mean, you almost would think the same thing of the gray wolf, but in Wisconsin, there are ways that you can go out to get close to these wolves. It's very hard to see them, but you can hear them. So you know, it had to do with whether there was an easy way to sort of access these animals.
What resources did you use to find out about these animals?
Once I had my list of animals, I contacted the DNR, was a good place to start. I contacted universities. I contacted volunteer groups and people who work with these animals, you know, day in and day out, and who would really know them and have some kind of stories to tell about them.
Well, you were working with the scientists and the DNR and the universities, but how did you make these connections? Did you just reach out to them and then network, or how did you go about making these connections?
Right. Well, sometimes it started that way, where I would just call the DNR and ask, you know, who was the go-to person for that particular animal. Other times, I found people through festivals. We have a lot of wildlife festivals in the state. There's a Prairie Chicken Festival. There's Owl Fest. And I would go to the festival or talk to some of the people there, sometimes contact the festival organizers ahead of time. There's also groups that are involved in conservation of certain types of animals, so I would contact them.
And then you stayed with some families, too. How did you make those connections?
Right. Well, that's particularly true of when I was researching the loons. And I found I stayed with a couple, Lorna Wilson and her husband, and I found them through Loon Watch, which is a program through the Northland College in Ashland. And they are what you call loon counters or loon rangers, and they live on the St. Croix flowage. So every year and every 5 years with the bigger count, they go out and count loons. I got their names and contacted them, and they were very gracious and let me come up and stay with them and count loons.
Wow. So how do you count loons?
Well, it's kind of a big process. Like I said, there's two different kinds of counts of loons, and every year there's what they just call the regular loon count. And it's usually people who live on a lake or a flowage, and they just volunteer to keep an eye on the lake and count the loons that they see during the summer and then send in a report. But every 5 years, there's a much bigger survey done, and it's done on a preset list of 258 lakes in Wisconsin. Everyone who does the count goes out on their lake at a certain time in the morning, mm-hmm. and then they count till a certain ending time, and then they fill out their forms and report that in, and then it's all put together in a big report, and we get our list of how many loons and how many chicks there are in Wisconsin.
So then you also wrote about the history of the animals and the land and the people who lived in these parts of Wisconsin. How did you find out that information?
Well, it was through research, and I think that brings up kind of a good point that this book is kind of a new genre in a way. As we were getting ready to go to publication, we were trying to figure out, you know, how to really categorize this book. It's almost hard to pigeonhole. It's a guidebook in that it tells you in what seasons to go look for what animals and what you can expect when you find them. And in other ways, it's sort of a history book like you mentioned, because I do go into the history of that particular form of wildlife in the state. It's also a nature sort of essay book because I tell the stories of the people who work with these animals. So it's really kind of hard to put it into one category. Also at the end of each chapter is a section on how to have your own genuine wildlife encounter, and there's a couple of options for you. And then also how to get involved in conservation efforts.
Because one of the things I really love about your book is that I'm reading it and I feel like I am just sitting there with you. I am out in the fields. I am out exploring and observing with you. One of my top favorite animals that I read about were the dancing prairie chickens, especially when the female prairie chickens were not all that impressed with the male prairie chickens.
So. Right.
Yeah. And what was your most fascinating experience you had while exploring these different habitats?
Well, first of all, that's great to hear because that's kind of the goal of the book, too, is to let you know what you're going to experience and, you know, how our experience were, either mine or someone I've talked to, and then what you can expect when you go out there. Boy, there were so many fascinating, you know, things that I hadn't done before. Like you say, sitting in a blind and watching the prairie chickens dance and also watching sharp-tailed grouse dance, which is a totally different experience. And I think we all expect some of these encounters to be fantastic, like encounters with the big animals like elk to be really spectacular, and they are. But I think what's really surprising is that you have these encounters with some of our native animals that are more common, and you wouldn't expect that. And one of those is the Canada goose. So many people say, well, why do I need to go to Horicon Marsh to watch the geese? They're in the city parks. They're in my backyard. They're all over the place. You know, I don't need to go to have this encounter with them. But the secret is that there are three kinds of Canada goose in Wisconsin. And just 50 years ago, we were actually afraid that they would go extinct. But they've really come back. And the thing is, seeing them at Horicon is just an international event. It's a phenomenon that people come from all over the world to see. You know, when you go to Horicon, you see hundreds of thousands of geese coming in at night. You don't get that in your city parks. And you don't get that in your backyard for sure. And I've talked to Bill Volkert, and he's a man who's a naturalist and an educator for the Wisconsin DNR, and he's worked there for almost 30 years, and he told me it never gets old. I mean, people who've been at a Horicon year after year and day after day still look up when all these geese come in, and it's just such a quintessential identity for Horicon. Mm-hmm. So I think those are kind of the surprising things that you can have. Encounters with these animals that you might see every day, but if you go to the right place at the right time, you'll really be amazed.
You were once a scriptwriter, but you have shifted to a nature writer role. Has your previous career influenced your nature writing throughout your books?
Yeah, I think so, because I think in any type of writing, whether it's drama or comedy or science or nature travel writing, what you're trying to do is tell a story. And so with the nature travel writing, the story you're trying to tell is the story of a place. And that's what I like to do, and what I try to do is tell the story of a place through the people who live there, work there, and who just love it.
Well, Candace Gockel-Andrews, thank you so much for being on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Candace Gockel-Andrews is the author of Travel Wild Wisconsin, a guide to seeing native animals in Wisconsin in their natural habitats. She lives in Sun Prairie, and she spoke with Eleanor Peterson in July. That's Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. It's great to have you listening today. As always, I sure hope you'll be with us tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.